tonight on Arena. Live music from cellist Patrick Dexter and Damien O'Mara on Welcome to Wrexham, Ryan Reynolds' foray into football. You can text us on 51551 or tweet at RTE Arena. During the first lockdown in 2020, music teacher Patrick Dexter found that he suddenly had a lot of time on his hands. He took to playing his cello outside his stone cottage overlooking Clew Bay and Croagh-Patrick. He recorded the performances, a mix of traditional Irish songs and classical pieces, at first to share with family and friends and later to post on Twitter. They quickly gained traction with people who were seeking comfort during a difficult time. The videos have been viewed by tens of millions of people to date, both in Ireland and internationally. Now Patrick has recorded some of those cello pieces along with a selection of his own compositions and released them on his solo album called Solace. Patrick joins me now from our Galway studio. Patrick, that setting perched outside your cottage with a view of the sea and the mountains, that and the music has been key to how it's connected worldwide.
Hi, it's wonderful to be with you. So in Ireland we have the sea, we have the wind, we have that windswept west coast of Ireland where I am, and it's something that really translates to people around the world, it seems. It's something that I love to accompany with my music, and it certainly has been part of the force that has brought me to this point, I think.
Describe the cottage and where it is and how you got yourself there.
Yeah, so it's an old land commission cottage. You know, it's an old building that was restored, and it's perched on the side of a hill along Clew Bay, with protected somewhat with the mountains from the main force of the western winds, but it settled in the bay, but also with a view out beyond Croagh-Patrick into the islands of Clew Bay and beyond. And I found myself there, after years of working abroad and the plan to settle and have my family with my partner, and we always had a dream of it happening in the west of Ireland, and an opportunity came, as you mentioned, with a teaching job here in the west, and we made it happen, and we stayed, and we've been here happily a good few years now.
So how did you, when did you start playing the cello? You're from a musical family.
I am. So I have a long relationship with the instrument. It's something that has sort of been with me in my life since I was a child. I grew up in a family of seven brothers and sisters. We all played instruments. My dad's a musician in Dublin, and he would have taught us classical music from a young age. And we all played together in a string ensemble. But I had many interests growing up, and I explored lots of different things. In university, I studied economics and politics, and that's where my interests were. But the cello was always something that was there with me, and it was something that really called to me in my, after I finished studying in university, and I was drawn back to it. And my relationship sort of became very closely intertwined in the last few years, as it became, for me, my main source of comfort, especially in the difficult last few years we've had, and also just a way of expressing myself. I'm very lucky that it was something that I was brought up with, but it's my relationship with it in adulthood, really, that has made it so special to me.
Now, describe how it came. First of all, was it every day you went out, if the weather was good enough, that you went out and recorded? Or how did that come about, that idea of sitting outside the cottage and playing and then recording what you were playing?
Well, you're certainly right there, Kay. The big part of that being when the weather is good enough, which is some of the time in the west of Ireland. I'd love to say it's every day, but when the weather comes out, it comes out spectacularly here on the West Coast. And I had a lot of time. I was also waiting. My wife was about to give birth to our first child, and there's a lot of anticipation and waiting around. And my teaching work had dried up due to the pandemic. So I was filling my days with music and playing outside as the weather improved that spring in 2020, if you can remember that. Long time ago, the weather was really exceptional in Ireland then, and playing outside was a natural part of that for me. But the thing that was different then was setting up my phone, the camera, to share it with the world. So when the weather was nice, yeah, I would have a, like I did every other day, have a melody, a tune that I wanted to play, whether it was from classical music or from Irish traditional music or from popular music or music that I write myself. I'd have that melody in my heart and my mind, and I'd want to play it. And when the weather was nice, I'd turn on the camera and share it with the world, and didn't think a whole lot of it. It was just something that was wonderful and freeing. But pretty much instantly I got this huge reaction from all around the world, something I never expected. Used to playing to just small crowds in my local town. Suddenly there was millions of people watching my playing, and yeah, it all just took off from there.
And what do you put the connection down to? Was it the beauty of the place and then that hauntingness of the cello?
I think there is something really special about the cello. I think the cello is an instrument, if you talk about it scientifically, it has a timbre, a resonance that's very similar to the tones of the human voice, which makes us, it could be subconsciously, but it makes you, feel a connection with it. It's something very human about the sound. But of course, it transcends language. It's an instrument. It makes musical sounds. And there's this form of connection that I feel the cello can make that is connected with the same innate feeling we have of connection with nature. And nature is something that you're really slapped in the face with, quite literally sometimes, with the wind and the rain in the west of Ireland. It comes out and it grabs you, and you can't be put on the coast here in Galway or in Mayo where I am without that impression of nature really coming and grabbing you. And I think those two things, nature and the cello, have something similar that I've always felt very strongly within me as is an important connection. But what I didn't expect was that this is something that perhaps is universal, because people all over the world felt the same thing with what I was sharing with my music.
Yes, and you've a great array of woolly jumpers, and then I was watching you perform Sally Gardens, and you're there in your T-shirt, and there's like a beautiful garden behind you.
Well, indeed, okay. T-shirt, yeah. Well, that was must have been a lovely sunny day. We've had some wonderful weather just recently. Yeah, whether it's a woolly jumper or a T-shirt, I just love playing outside, you know, and in the winter, naturally, you get wrapped up. But in the summer, there's nothing better than being out in a T-shirt and your sandals and playing music in the garden. It's particularly wild garden in the west of Ireland. You probably saw not the kind of prim flowers that maybe you'd have on a garden show, but certainly a wild array of the explosion, especially of the gorse bushes, which is perhaps what you saw on that video.
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, is an event that happens twice a year where we are, and it is incredible. The strong colour of yellow that sweeps the hillsides is a really incredible spectacle that's always overlooked because it's not a very popular plant, really, the gorse bush. But like that, now you have the heather covering the hills. They're lighting up with purple as the season comes to the end of the summer. And there's all these moments throughout the year, the seasons, they change and they have their specific beauty, and that's something that I love looking back at some of the performances I did. I didn't think of it at the time, but now how it catalogues those seasons in Ireland in the throughout the year.
Yes, and as well as, I mean, as we've said, your videos have been viewed by millions of people, and including some very famous people. What kind of famous people have you attracted? Feel free to name drop.
Okay, you're making me blush now. Mm-hmm. That can't be seen on radio, so that's okay.
Yeah.
No, I mean, a few wonderful moments have happened. I mean, for me, musically, it was really wonderful. I was reached out to by Glenn Hansard when I played one of his tunes, and Marketa Irglova, they wrote the soundtrack of Once Together.
Yes.
Of course, won the Oscar. And they loved my version of one of their tunes so much that they, you know, were sharing it online. And then I was asked to be part of Marketa Irglova's recording of her latest single, which was an absolutely incredible thing for me musically. But as I said, I studied politics in college and economics in my postgrad, and that part of me was blown away when I was reached out to by Christiane Amanpour, who is sort of a journalist hero of mine, and she wanted to interview me and have her on her show, and because she was a fan, and that was definitely a high point.
Yes, and the President of the United States.
Yes, so I had the amazing opportunity in the deep dark lockdown of 2020 of playing for the St. Patrick's Day events, which were happening virtually. Unfortunately, I didn't get to go over to the US then, but they were happening as part of the Irish Embassy in USA. They put on a remote performance for audiences, including the President of America, Joe Biden. And that was something that I played and was part of from my cottage, which was incredible. I played the beautiful tune, one of Joe Biden's favourites, Raglan Road, from the cottage. And it was beamed by the magic of the internet all the way to the US. Incredible opportunity.
And today you're beaming to the people of Ukraine. I was looking at your feed today and you've celebrated Ukraine Independence Day.
Yes, today is a day that many of our minds are on the people of Ukraine. This is something that, even though we're on the very far side of Europe, I feel it's something that over this last year has been in all our hearts. And that's something I like to reflect in the music that I play and share. So I shared today, I recorded myself playing Translates' On a Moonlit Night. It's an old tune by Mykola Lysenko, who is one of the great nationalist Ukrainian composers. If you look into his story of what happened to him and what he suffered for his nationalist tendencies, it's a wonderful story, a harrowing, sad story. But I shared one of his pieces, which is later to play on the TV live over in the UK, which I'm very happy about. But bringing something from my life, studying politics and my interests in the world is something that I was always told had no place in music, really, but it always felt it did for me. So, playing Ukrainian music at this time, something that feels like it has a lot of power for me, and I feel very, very blessed to be doing it.
Absolutely. And then you have launched your album and you have recorded that album in situ at the cottage. Was that a difficult thing to do? I know you've been recording on your phone, but doing an album and the standard of recording that it requires and yet trying to keep that atmosphere, was that a difficult challenge?
Okay, yeah. So it's a different world, you know. Recording an album, something I've wanted to do all my life, and I had the opportunity. Of course, it was still lockdown when this was recorded last year, and I wanted to take this opportunity. It was not easy to go into a studio, and then I also thought that this perhaps wasn't a place that I really wanted to share this music, because it felt it had its birthplace out in nature, in the wild, in the west of Ireland, and especially in the cottage. So I had this crazy idea, which turned a lot of sound engineers off, which was to record it all in the cottage with microphones set up as I played, to take in all the sounds of nature and the breeze, the stream, the birds in particular at that time of year in the west of Ireland. And all those sounds that in this studio I'm in right now, we're trying to keep out. I wanted to keep them in, and this was something I luckily had a friend that I grew up with, a great sound engineer, and he had the vision to make it happen. So we recorded this album live with all the sounds of nature pulsing throughout it. And then I went back and recorded some cello harmonies and various things over it. But it was left very bare, very raw, and it felt wonderful to be able to have the confidence to do something that is so, especially for the cello, which is in the classical a music sphere, most of all, to do something very unconventional and a little controversial, but I'm really happy with the results. And the response has been incredible. You know, getting into the charts in the US, which is very unusual for an independent release, was really incredible.
Well, there'll be tracks, Joe Biden's favourite, Raglan Road, Carrick Fergus, Lark in the Clear Air, and Wild Mountain Time. But we're going to play The Parting Glass, which you're going to play for us live down in Galway, and we really appreciate that you're doing that, and people can hear it with the sound effects from your cottage by downloading your album Solace on your website. That's patrickdexter.com. Patrick, thank you very much, and this is The Parting Glass.
Thank you. Wonderful.
In In the Disney Plus's Welcome to Wrexham, Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds learn to run the third oldest professional football club in the world. In 2020, Rob and Ryan teamed up to purchase the Red Dragons in the hopes of turning Wrexham AFC into an underdog story that the whole world could root for. But Rob and Ryan have no experience in football or working with each other even. The docuseries tracks Rob and Ryan's crash course in football club ownership and the connection and the connected fates of the team and its town. I'm joined now by Damien O'Mara, who's been watching Welcome to Wrexham. I suppose, Damien, tell us a little bit about Wrexham Football Club, first of all.
Wrexham is one of the kind of great last standing heroes of British football. As you mentioned, the oldest football club in Wales. They play like Cardiff and Swansea and a couple of other teams. They play in the English leagues. They're in the fifth tier of English football, but they are the oldest club in Wales, the third oldest football club in the world, which is still functioning. And they play at the Racecourse Ground, which is the longest running international football stadium in the world. So a venue which hosts international football. And it's very obviously been a club which has been in decline over the last couple of years. People of a certain vintage would have remembered them playing in the second tier of English football over the years and, you know, would have been giant killers in the FA Cup, but they have been in free fall in recent years and find themselves in the National League, which is the fifth tier.
Okay, so yeah. There's the Premiership, the Championship.
Premiership, Championship, League One, League Two, National League. So, okay. National League, you would have a situation where they would be at the upper end. Some of their players, most of their players are professional, but you would be into the world of semi-pro or fellas who are playing love, not necessarily for the money, but for the love of the game or the hope of progressing into the Football League.
So why on earth did Ryan Reynolds, a film star, and Rob McElhenney, a TV star, decide they wanted to buy the club?
So we'll come to Reynolds is kind of the, I won't say the innocent party, but he's been the one who's effectively been dragged into it of the two. Rob McElhenney, who, I'll be very honest with you, I know Ryan Reynolds and I've seen Deadpool and his various films over the years. It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia, which is McElhenney's series, kind of had passed me by over the years, but he's spoken more about this in media than they necessarily do in the series itself. Fell upon Sunderland Till I Die, which a lot of people will be familiar with, the Netflix series, which is a fly on the wall of Sunderland and quite a chaotic running of that football club. He saw it, got quite intrigued by this, as you mentioned, the connecting fates between the football club and the town. And if one is in decline, the other falls into decline. Likewise, he quite got taken by the relationship. He's a Philadelphia native and quite got into the connection or the similarity between these towns, Wrexham, Sunderland and Philadelphia.
OK, well, let's listen to him talk about that connection between growing up in Philadelphia. This is Rob McElhenney, and how he identified with the people of Wrexham.
I'm from Philadelphia, and I've always been a sports fanatic. I couldn't play anything, but I always loved watching it. My whole family would love the Eagles. It was just something that was a part of my life from the time I can remember. The team becomes an extension of the city. Even as a kid, I just remember that. It gave me something to identify with. I grew up in South Philadelphia, on the corner of Moy Mensing and Dickinson. The Philadelphia that I know and the Philadelphia as it identifies itself are people who work really hard for everything that they have. One of the things that was really attractive about Wrexham is, even though I've never been there, the town reminds me of Philadelphia. Yeah. It's a working class town, it's a blue collar town. It's a town that has had its ups and downs, and they haven't had all the opportunities that a lot of other people have had. I feel like I know those people, and I grew up with those people. I am one of those people.
Wrexham, Philadelphia, I'd never have thought of twinning them myself.
In a certain light, dark, probably. To be fair to him, I think he comes across quite genuine in it. So the club had a series of owners who had mismanaged the club and was eventually taken over by a supporters trust in 2011. And then there was 2,000 members, 2,000 supporters owned the club. So basically, the two boyos land in on a Zoom call and pitch the idea of buying the club, which initially was rejected. And this doesn't feature in the documentary. Initially, when the approach was made, it was completely dismissed. And then once people found out that it's Ryan Reynolds and this other guy, they kind of went, oh, we're interested in this. So eventually, 98.6% of those who voted in the referendum on selling the club passed it.
Okay. So meanwhile, back in the States, Rob McElhenney, before they do this pitch, doesn't have the money, because as he says, he has TV money and he needed movie star money.
Yeah.
So then he lists out Ryan Reynolds. He's fairly new pal. What kind of business ventures he has and thinks he might be a good partner.
Can't you theoretically take a team that's in the lowest league and bring them to the top? He said yes. But as I started to gather more and more information, I realized how expensive it was going to be. I have TV money, but as I started to look at how expensive it actually was to run a club, I realized that I needed something more than TV money. I needed movie star money.
But sometimes you gotta let your heart lead you. Even if you know it's someplace you know you're not supposed to be.
More than that, I needed superhero movie star money.
Time to make the chimmy fucking chongas.
More than that, probably, as we ascended up the leagues, I would need alcohol baron money.
Aviation American gin.
And mobile phone services money. And what are the companies this bitch has?
Cybersecurity
money.
So Ryan Reynolds has all these businesses being a superhero.
Yeah, there's a lot more to him than Deadpool.
How much money do you need to buy a football club?
The reports are that they spent $2 million to buy it. Now, as it progresses, you get to see that they completely revamped the stadium. It's a bit of a decoration job more than anything else, rather than a massive construction job. They do a job on the pitch, which costs $200,000. They make a hames of it. They have to spend an extra $100,000. Well, not them, but the people that did it make a hames of it. So they spend another $100,000 on it. So $300,000 on the pitch. And then, as you see, their manager doesn't achieve the goals that have been set for him. So there's a change in management. They bring in a very, very well-regarded manager. And then as the series progresses, they realise, well, we need a guy to start scoring goals. So they bring in a very well-reputed striker. So there has significant money has gone into it.
And are they improving?
So the series starts where they're towards the tail end of not the current season, the season before. And basically they need to get into the playoffs to give them an opportunity for promotion. They fail. They get rid of the manager. They've made a very good start to the season. They beat Maidstone 5-0 at the weekend, including, wow, I think it was a hat trick from the star striker who features in it. So there was quite a lot of promo material in the Sunday papers over the weekend, and one that caught my eye was the manager of an opposing club who said, well, most of us are operating on a budget of around £1 million a year. He reckoned Wrexham are now currently operating on a budget closer to £2 million a year. So they have put money into it. One of the intriguing things that you see in it is they're very conscious of the fact that we are coming in here like two hotshots throwing money around. If this goes wrong, our reputation is going to suffer. They get quite integrated into the community and doing ads for the local haulage company who are their sponsors. They've now all been replaced. The new shirt jersey sponsor is TikTok. They've got Expedia on the back of the jersey. Mm-hmm. Other social media and travel companies are available.
And do they have control over, this is Ryan Reynolds and Rob McElhenney, are they in control of this TV series and the the documentary?
Yeah, and it's quite evident that did the documentary series idea come before the notion to buy the football club, or did buying the football club come before the notion? Because when they're there pitching to the fans, there is a considerable film crew with them filming them in their house. So it's like a Zoom meeting of old where they've laptops stacked up on piles of books. So very early on in the process, someone obviously decided we are going to make, not necessarily a Sunderland Till I Die, it's kind of somewhere between Sunderland Till I Die and Ted Lasso.
Oh, right, Ted, which is the drama series, yeah, which has won so many awards.
Because
the Apple TV, isn't
it? Yeah, there are elements of it where they are quite evidently targeting an audience who don't know where Wrexham or Wales is and who don't know anything about association football. So it is, if you're dyed-in-the-wool football fans, there are aspects of this that are going to annoy you because it's like the Sesame Street guide to how football works. And you get these little cutaways every so often which explain what the word nil means, or chocka. The local pub is chocka, and this is what chocka means. So it's obviously targeting an American audience rather than a diehard football audience. And that's evident throughout.
Now, we should play a clip of Ryan Reynolds, because he being the most famous of the investors. Here he talks about his childhood in a working class family and how he always needed validation from his father.
I grew up in a working class family, and I have three older brothers. My father struggled in a number of different ways. My dad started as a cop, then became a food broker, which sounds like a cover for a CIA agent or something, but it was his actual job.
Oh my God!
Main place I got validation from my father, like if I was good at sports, in my father's eyes, I was doing all right. So I played sports long past the point where I was like really driven to play sports.
Go back to like there, right here.
Yeah.
Okay, here we go.
It carried on. I carried on all through show business, all that stuff. You know, it's like an unquenchable thirst for validation. My father's been dead for years, but like it's, you know, he kind of, stuff doesn't really go away. It's easy to sort of think of him, you know, the way I'm describing it, as like a really hard ass. He would have thought all this was wild. Like, you know, he didn't really see any of this stuff Deadpool forward. So I think he would have thought this was all pretty crazy.
Oh, poor Deadpool.
And that's a big part of it. And because I have no doubt there's very well-to-do Wrexham fans, but the fans that they feature are like the guy who runs the local chipper, the guy who runs the local pub, painter and decorator. Like it's very working class, you know, but it's enjoyable.
So overall, do you think there's enough of a balance between the Hollywood crew and the people of Wrexham? And is it a good watch for people? You know, I think people in Ireland at least would have a good idea about English league football.
I'll be very honest with you. The episodes are about 27 minutes long. With Sunderland Till I Die and some of the other series like this, I have sat down and I would watch 10 of them back to back. I watched maybe two of these and then went, no, I need a break from it now. I think once you understand it's not targeted towards people who have grown up with a full awareness of football, it's very entertaining, and they've obviously set out to have an entertain, like a comedic side to it as well. There are parts of it that you'll be looking at it like smacking your head off the table thinking, what do they think they're doing, or where are these lads going? But overall, is it a Sunderland Till I Die? Not quite. It probably doesn't want to be, but it's very enjoyable.
Very good. Well, my thanks to Damien O'Mara. Welcome to Wrexham will be available this Friday on Disney Plus. You're listening to Wednesday Night's Arena. Three friends in their 60s decide to go travelling in Claire McMahon's new comedy, The Gap Year, at the Lyric Theatre Belfast, much to the horror of their adult children. They're all, for various reasons, at something of a crossroads in their lives. Carl Moore plays Kate, newly widowed. Marion O'Dwyer is Una, reluctant divorcee. And Libby Smith is Roisin, trapped as chief babysitter by her demanding daughters. The women plan to visit all 32 counties in Ireland on their gap year. Carl Moore and the director of Gap Year, Benjamin Gould, join me now. Carol, can you tell us who is Kate, the character you're playing, and how the gap year comes about?
Well, the play opens with the prologue of Kate's husband's funeral, Joe, and very quickly moves on to a living room scene where her and her friend Una are discussing families and all the things you would discuss over a cup of tea. And the idea is muted that maybe Kate needs to get a break after the funeral, which feels really inappropriate. But anyway, she agrees to a few days if they can also bring the friend Roisin. And a few days extends, and they move from a tent to a camper van, and suddenly they're doing a gap year around Ireland. So the play is really exploring how these three women bring a lot of baggage with them, and how on their journey across the counties and the people they meet, how it impacts on their lives in that moment and also on the future decisions they're going to make.
Ben, you described this play as something of an old school buddy movie. What can you tell us about the other two women, Róisín and Una?
Yeah, I mean, obviously they're all kind of great friends that have been friends since their childhoods. So they've got that kind of magical rapport that only exists when you've known people for a very long time. And so Una is separated from her husband for just over 20 years. But the time has finally come that he wants a divorce rather than just sort of living separately, and this starts to bring up a lot of old memories for her, and she finds it quite uncomfortable. And Róisín has, you know, she's given over her life to other people. She's looked after her husband for years. She looked after her husband's mother when he got sick. She looked after her kids, and now she's on to looking after the grandkids, and she's never quite taken the time for herself. As Carol's kind of saying, you know, this play is a chance for those three women to take a bit of time for themselves and think about who they are and what they want in life.
Carol, what are the issues that come up for the people, for the women? They're all in their 60s, so is ageism and self-consciousness maybe about their age a thing that affects them?
It absolutely affects them, and they very much represent how women in their 60s, and I'm one of them, feel, because when I turned 60, I made a very conscious decision about how I wanted to be seen and how I wanted to behave, because I think it's probably one of the isms left. It is very much on the one hand, a taboo subject as far as I'm concerned, but yet been absolutely normalised in society. And people use ageist language about women all the time, and it is accepted. And certainly when I was writing my own play about ageing, I was very conscious that as women, we needed to challenge that in our own lives and when we heard it. And I think these three women have probably accepted that. At the point at which Kate goes to buy a camper van, this young man in his 30s is being completely patronising. And she has to absolutely say, I'm not going to be treated like an old woman. You know, you're showing me the most expensive models. You're telling me I can't drive that camper van because it's too big, and I'm not going to accept it. I'm also not going to accept that you won't negotiate the price. And all the women are going through these issues. I mean, Una just feels really stuck in her life because she didn't make a choice to end the marriage. Her husband just walked out on her. And Róisín is going through all sorts of issues on her own, and her children take her very much for granted. And we discussed in rehearsals the many women of our age in our lives who, when they become retired, you would think that they might want to go and do things for themselves, take up a hobby or new challenges, and end up looking after all their grandchildren. And that becomes their life for the next 15 or 20 years.
The play you wrote was a one-woman play called The Experience of Being. But Carl, all your life you have been fighting to make women, whatever age they are, visible in your work through Sharabank and beyond that. So, I mean, you have always been very vocal about demanding parts for women when they weren't available especially during the Troubles, for example, where there was a lot of things looking at the male attitude to the Troubles in Northern Ireland.
Absolutely. In the early 80s, it was an absolute frustration. Not just there weren't enough roles here for young women, because often female actors were brought in from England, but it was playing peripheral roles, very much how women of my age, female actors, would feel now, that there is an underrepresentation of women in their 50s, 60s, 70s on the stage. But certainly then, when we were in our 20s, we wanted to do something like that. And I think the different thing about us then, we were very much tiptoeing around that until we found a way through it, because there wasn't an independent theatre scene. Mm-hmm. And the wonderful thing I see about young women now, they absolutely feel empowered from the moment they go to drama school and come out of drama school fully formed as young feminists, as young women who want to write, who want to act, want to produce their own work. And that certainly wasn't the case when we started out. I mean, Charabang was very much my politicisation, my understanding about feminism and where I find my empowerment.
Ben, this sounds, listening to Carol there, that this could be a very educational experience for you as a director.
It's a pretty special experience to be able to work with three such talented actors in those three leads. And then, you know, the rest of the cast are obviously fabulous as well, with Megan Tyler and Frankie McCafferty and Keith Singleton. But how often do you get to see a play with three women in their 60s as the leads? You know, it just doesn't happen. Even to have a woman in her 60s as a lead, it doesn't happen. So it's a really amazing experience as a director to be able to see those women go on that journey and to work with them and see all of what they can bring to the table. You know, they've got this huge wealth of experience, and to be able to kind of tap into those things and to be able to challenge them to do some things that they maybe haven't had the chance to do, because, which is a real shame, you know, they haven't had a chance to do because they haven't seen all of these parts come up.
And Ben, the play was written by your wife and the playwright Claire McMahon. So presumably there's conversations going on at home and there's conversations in the rehearsal room all around these issues of ageism.
Absolutely. You know, Claire was writing this play for 4.5 years, and from the very beginning she was, you know, engaging in conversations with women in their 60s, and of course, you know, she's got plenty of aunts and her mother and you know, people at home and friends of the family and all that sort of thing that she was talking to as well, just tapping into their experiences. And you know, I'm so glad that I've been alongside for some of that and been able to see how this has developed. And then of course, once we get it into the room, you know, we're opening it and I'm trying to draw on their experience, because, you know, what do I have to teach them about being women in their 60s? That's not my job at all. They bring so much to the table.
Of course. And Carol, what are you hoping audiences will get out of the play?
Well, first of all, I think they'll laugh their heads off. It actually doesn't matter that these women in their 60s in terms of comedy, because whether you're in your 20s, your 40s, your 60s, women love to get together. And when they get together and for a long period of time, bit of gossiping, bit of bickering, a bit of fighting and that, there's so much comedy joy to be had from that. But beyond that, of course, there's big issues. There's issues about grief and the stages of grief and how one navigates oneself through all of that. There's the breakdown of marriage. there is falling in love again when you're 60s. And, you know, that's another taboo subject. People don't think of women in their 60s as being sexy or having sex or having affairs. But, of course, all of that goes on. So, and then there's all the other wonderful characters that Keith and Megan and Frankie, who play husbands and men on the journey, and
it sounds like a great night out. The Gap Year is at the Lyric Theatre Belfast from the 3rd to the 25th of September. Further details at lyrictheatre.co.uk. And Carl Moore and Benjamin Gould, thank you very much.
Thank you.
25 years ago this week, English band Oasis released their much-anticipated third album, Be Here Now. It quickly became the fastest-selling album in UK chart history, reaching number one in 15 countries. The album was launched just 4 years after Definitely Maybe, the band's debut album, which had blazed into popular culture, and 2 years after their second album, What's the Story, Morning Glory, which became one of the defining albums of the decade. Joining us to assess the album on its silver anniversary, we are joined by music journalist Eamon Sweeney. So take us back to 1997, Eamon, when this album was launched. The hype around Oasis was immense, and they were considered not just one of the biggest bands in the UK, but in the world.
They were in the news, in the media, it seemed like 24/7. It was tabloid fodder. The complex relationship, for want of a better word, between the brothers. It just made for this soap opera that was never ending. And their imperial phase between 93 to 1996, they really were bigger than anything. And there is no current parallel or comparison whatsoever. I remember when Liam Gallagher being arrested on Oxford Street on a Saturday morning, and I remember this kind of breaking on the news, probably as the second news item. You know, it's extraordinary. You know?
Now, they were with Creation Records, and tell us how they were treated at their record company.
They were really pretty much, retrospectively, Noel Gallagher has kind of said, well, there's all these people in Creation who have been working in the music business for 20 years, and they should have put an arm around us and told us, you know, go off and take a year out. You cannot stand each other. The only motivation for making this album was money and ego. But gleaned on kind of stuff that Noel has said over the years, I've been lucky enough to speak to him a few times, and they really were in that position where is they called the shots. The classic example of that being, like, you know, before this album came out, the perfect single to come back on would have been The Master Plan, which is probably my favourite Oasis song. It was a B-side. And Alan McGee and the powers that be in Creation Records said, this is, do not waste this, stockpile this. And he refused point blank on, you know, I don't write bad songs. Well, it ran out of gas on Be Here Now. There are bad songs and even worse songs on the subsequent album. Everybody seemed to be, and they make no bones about this whatsoever, this insane, coked up, paranoid, brash, completely unsophisticated, just totally detached from reality. And this record is detached from reality. It's kind of, it's entertaining to listen to, in one sense, and absolutely mortifying. It's a very interesting time capsule.
Now, it was, there was, as with all the albums from great bands and such popular bands, there was great hype around its launch date.
Yes.
And you absolutely joined that hype.
I joined that hype. It's the only time I've been in a record shop at 7 in the morning. The Tower Records, then on Wicklow Street, opened at 7 in the morning because, if memory serves me correctly, I was a big avid reader of the UK music press at the time, and there was so much going on. Like, HMV were issuing first day sales certificates to people who bought it from HMV. But the only activity in Ireland that I was aware of anyway was that Tower Records had this kind of fancy date stamp on the cover of the album. And I literally was there probably in a smallish queue. You know, it wasn't like U2 you know, opening up record stores at midnight, but it wasn't far off. And because of that, and I listened to it obsessively for a couple of days, and it's only kind of now that I'd say it has to be the first time in about 25 years since I've listened to the full thing from beginning to end.
Now, you've picked out some of the tracks. So we'll play Do You Know What I Mean? And there's a good introduction into that. So we'll play it and you talk to us about it, because there's helicopter sounds, so we won't upset them by talking.
Yeah, it's helicopters, and there's also this bleeping going around about Morse code.
Yeah. Yeah. I heard the Morse code bit, so we've kind of faded it there before the presumably profound statement that Noel Gallagher has written then.
Absolutely.
In the lyrics.
All my people right here, right now, do you know what I mean? He kind of said that he wanted to come up with kind of something conceptual and failed, so he said, oh, I'll keep it as ambiguous as possible. And that pretty much kind of sums up the lyric writing on this record.
And was he disappointed with that lyric?
I'd say now, yes, he is. I say at the time, given the amount of substance going on, he probably thought it was the greatest thing ever. I think one.
And it sold. I mean, it sold 9 million records,
yeah,
or something.
9 million sales. So
yeah, yeah.
It's often kind of described as, you know, the biggest flop of all time. Well, it's not a flop if it sold 9 million records. It's probably arguably the best, worst album of all time. As in, it really does sum up an era that was changing. And I think Oasis, 1997, we look back now, the records that we're going to be talking about in 100 years' time from 1997 are going to be Radiohead's OK Computer. And 10 days after this album was released, it had the death of Lady Diana in a car crash in Paris. The public mood in England completely, completely changed. And then I think very different kind of indie pop stars emerged from that. People like Coldplay and Travis. Nice, wholesome, and lots of melody. The problem with Beer Here Now is it's just like a dirge. It's just like this wall of noise.
But at the time, put yourself back there before Lady Diana died, before, you know, you're looking at Oasis progressing. Did you buy it?
I bought it to an extent. I've always thought that this record is really far too long. Listen to it now. I think the first half of it is still very good. Certainly far from the best work they've done, but certainly far from the worst. All around the world, back 25 years ago, I don't know, I'm mortified that I like that song. I hear it now and kind of go,
okay, okay, let's have a listen to All Around the World and we'll have a chat about it then. Eamon, All Around the World. Do you feel any differently about it, having listened to it there, even ever so briefly?
Well, not as bad as had we listened to the entire 9 minutes of that, because it goes on and it builds and it builds.
I think you're half embarrassed that you liked it so much before and now
yeah,
you're just...
Yeah, a little bit. A little bit. Mind you, do you know what I mean? Stand By Me, I think, still kind of stands up. It's fun to look back on this album. You know, nostalgia can be a terrifying thing at times. I don't think we're ever going to see the likes of this album ever again, which is probably a good thing.
Well, that was music journalist Eamon Sweeney reviewing Oasis' third album, Be Here Now, which was released 25 years ago. I don't think you'll be going queuing up 7 a.m. to buy it soon. Liam Gallagher, one half of the now defunct Oasis, plays Dublin's Royal Hospital Kilmainham this Saturday, where you may or may not hear him sing some tracks from Be Here Now. No, Eamon is laughing at that. That's it for tonight's show. The programme was researched by Liam Murphy and Paula Shields. Mark McGraw was on sound, and in Galway, John Doyle. Michelle Gibson was the broadcast coordinator. Tonight's show was produced by Regina Luby.